Network Online. The time now is 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Although there are serious concerns about collapsing colony syndrome and its impact on honeybees, scientists and farmers are beginning to learn that native wild bees are the best pollinators and that when they pollinate crops, yields double. But like commercial hive honeybees, native wild bees are facing serious threats. Pesticides, pathogens, and industrial farming are devastating their numbers, leading scientists to ask, is there a better way to work with them? It's a question that award-winning journalist and author Rowan Jacobson addressed in a recent Huffington Post article called Are We Handling the Bee Crisis All Wrong? And I'm very pleased that it brings Rowan Jacobson to our show now. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
What role do pollinators play in our food system?
They are responsible for about one of every three bites of food we put in our mouths and about 75% of the fruits and vegetables that we eat. So they play a huge role.
How often must a blueberry plant, for example, be pollinated in order to produce fruit?
So the pollination happens during when the plants flower. So in the spring, the blueberries flower, and then for every blueberry produced requires a bee to come in there and cross-pollinate, so to take pollen from one plant and carry it to the flower on another plant.
So they have to touch each flower?
Yeah, they have to touch each flower. And if the flower doesn't get touched, it won't turn into a blueberry.
What led Charlie Nicholson to stalk a bumblebee in a row of blueberry bushes at Knoll Farm in Vermont?
So Charlie is or was a grad student at the University of Vermont. He just graduated, just got his PhD, but this was his thesis. He was curious about how much pollination was being delivered by wild bees instead of by honeybees. And that's hard to study in most of the country because there's honeybees everywhere, so you can't really separate out what they're doing. Vermont is lightly populated, and there just aren't that many honeybee colonies around. So it seemed like a perfect place to study the impact of wild bees.
Now, we're talking about wild bees, honeybees, bumblebees. Are they all very different?
They are. There's actually 20,000 different species of bees in the world. And they vary hugely in size and habits and flowers that they like. And there's only one of those 20,000, the honeybee, that we've domesticated and that we sort of think of when we think about pollination. They all do it.
Are honeybees native to the United States?
They're not. They evolved in Africa, and then they naturally moved up into Europe. So they're native to Africa and Europe. They didn't hit North America until they came over with the colonists in the 1500s and 1600s.
A beekeeper told one of my producers that there are no feral honeybees left in the United States, that all honeybees are from commercial hives.
Yeah.
Is that true?
It is. People don't realize that. There used to be feral bees. Like, after they were brought over, they spread. In fact, there's this this famous quote from Thomas Jefferson talking about how the Native Americans called the honeybee the white man's fly because it kind of spread west with the colonists, and they had never seen it before. And so then it did go feral and occupied the wilds in the U.S., but all those feral bees died out due to a parasite called Varroa that came in from Asia and preys on honeybees and pretty much took out all the wild colonies and is a constant problem for the managed colonies as well.
So the colonists, the Europeans, brought bees with them. That's kind of like when the pilgrims brought turkeys to the Americas, not realizing that there already were turkeys here.
Exactly. Actually, that's a perfect metaphor. Because, yeah, the honeybee did not exist here and immediately became problematic for the native bees, basically by competing with them.
Well, much has been written and said about the importance of honeybees in sustaining life. Well, are there other bees or pollinators that can step in if collapsing colony syndrome wipes them out?
There are, and that's one thing that scientists are really just starting to realize now. And I'm as guilty as everyone else of sort of focusing on honeybees. I wrote a book about honeybee collapse about a decade ago.
Called Fruitless Fall.
Right, right. And I totally focus on honeybees as our only hope for pollination. But now, now with their sort of increasingly sophisticated studies that can start to divide the contributions of honeybees and wild bees, turns out wild bees, On a bee-by-bee basis, wild bees are much, much better pollinators than honeybees. What honeybees bring to the table is huge numbers. You know, they live in these hives of 40,000 bees, while wild bees are solitary.
They don't live in hives?
No, only honeybees. Honeybees are weird. They went down a weird little evolutionary path where they live in these massive colonies. They're very urban kind of insects, and other bees don't do that.
And the only reason that they wind up being productive in pollinating is because they need to create and store honey in their hives. So they are going from flower to flower to get the pollen, but it's just accidental that they're pollinating?
Right, and that's the way nature developed the whole system between flowers and bees. The bees are just in it for food. Like, they're trying to get the pollen, which is kind of their protein, and the nectar, which is their sugar water. It's their energy, their carbohydrates. But by visiting all the flowers, you know, bees have those little furry bodies. They pick up the pollen, and then when they visit the next plant, they accidentally brush off some of the pollen on that flower, and that's plant sex, basically. Like, that's how the sperm from one plant gets to the next plant. They let the bees carry it. But the bees are just in it for the food.
Well, is that true with the wild pollinators as well, the ones that don't live in hives?
It is. They're just foraging for food. When you see flowers out there, that's food for bees and basically billboards saying "eat here" for bees. And the wild pollinators actually tend to visit more different flowers because they are solitary. So, you know, just like you eat a different variety of foods throughout the day, they do the same thing. They'll sort of bounce all over the place. Honeybees have this other, like, hive mentality where they go out, they get lots and lots of nectar, they bring it straight back to the hive and unload it and turn it into honey. So they actually aren't as good at carrying pollen between different plants because they tend to go to one plant, fill up, and then go back to the hive. So it's turning out that they have great numbers, so if you don't have any other pollination going on, it's good to have them. But probably your first option should be a healthy population of wild bees.
Well, wild bees developed along with the rest of the ecosystem, so they are part of the whole normal process, whereas the honeybees are an invasive species. Are they as likely to go to all the plants, the invasive ones, as well as the native plants?
The honeybees are definitely generalists. It seems like they'll hit lots of different plants, but they don't know how to pollinate a lot of the plants that are native to North America because, as you said, they didn't evolve with them. So a lot of our crops that are native here, like blueberries and all the squashes and pumpkins, require this thing called buzz pollination. So they actually keep their pollen hidden inside these tubes that have little holes in them, and a bee has to grab the tube and shake it at exactly the right frequency to get the little pollen grains to come out. And that frequency, it's like a middle or a high C. It's kind of like the hey in Hey Jude, which I will not try to do for you. But bumblebees and other bees that evolve with these plants know how to buzz pollinate. So if you watch them on these plants, you can hear it. Like, they'll be buzzing along with that low buzz, and then they'll go into the plant and they'll grab a hold of it, and then you'll hear them make this high pitched sound. Like, it almost sounds like they're struggling. They go like, and that's that high C, which causes the pollen to come out, and then they get it and they carry it around. Honeybees don't know how to do that, so they're really poor pollinators of squashes, blueberries, cranberries, things like that.
Honeybees are commercially bred on the whole. Have commercial beekeepers been part of the process, part of the problem that you're writing about here?
It's looking like they are, and really, like, through no fault of their own, because they're just trying to keep their bees alive and make a living. But what's happened in the U.S. is because, as our agricultural systems have become more and more industrial, you now have huge monocrops of things like almonds and apples in areas where there's very few other things growing out there besides that crop. So you don't have any wild areas nearby where wild pollinators can visit from. So that's when you need to bring in honeybees. So the entire honeybee industry, we think of beekeepers as making honey, but honey is actually a very small part of their income. They make it almost all through pollination rentals. So their bees spend a lot of their year on the back of a tractor-trailer truck going from crop to crop, following the bloom, as they call it. They'll hit the almond orchards in California in February and pollinate and just unload hundreds of hives to pollinate the almonds. Then they'll load those hives back onto the truck and go visit apples, blueberries in the Northeast, apples, and so on, pumpkins. They'll sort of follow the bloom to different crops in different states. So the honeybees actually put quite a few miles on their meter every year.
How many commercial beehives do we have in the United States?
We have about 2.5 million, and wow, it's kind of interesting. For years, we've been hearing about this collapse of honeybees, honeybee colonies, but that number has held at about 2.5 million for at least 20 years. It's been a little bit misleading where you hear about the deaths that happen each winter, and we'll hear that 30% or 35% of the honeybee colonies died over the winter, but that's kind of built into the ecology of honeybee hives. Like, a certain amount of them just naturally dies in the winter, and then you could grow new colonies in the spring by dividing the colonies you have, so you can turn one colony into two.
But they die because of the cold. They can't hibernate.
Right, they die. The cold and the lack of flowers. Winters are tough on honeybees. They're really a tropical species, so winters are a challenge for them. But anyway, we've had the same number of hives for a couple of decades, and worldwide we've never had so many honeybee hives. I think we're up to something like 80 million hives worldwide, and growing quickly.
So this is something that's also happening in Europe and Asia and South America and Africa as well?
Yes, especially Asia and Africa, the number of honeybee hives is exploding.
You write, I'm quoting, although a few food plants such as grains are wind-pollinated, most require an animal to do it. And as you pointed out, bees with their furry bodies and floral enthusiasm do the majority of that.
Right. And so honeybees are increasingly filling in for places that have killed their wild bees worldwide.
Now, there are other animals that also pollinate, don't they? Bats, certain birds, like hummingbirds.
Exactly, yeah.
Are wasps pollinators?
Wasps do a little bit of it. They're also predatory. They do some pollination. They also prey on other insects. But hummingbirds, for sure, a lot of the red flowers out there, especially ones that have that are really deep, have like these long, deep tubes, are designed specifically for hummingbirds. And bats are famously important for pollinating a lot of the cactuses in the Southwest.
So bats, which people are afraid of, and bees, which people are afraid of, actually are absolutely necessary for sustaining life.
Absolutely. But get rid of the bees and the bats, and all the plants are going to disappear too.
I'm speaking with Rowan Jacobson, who is an award-winning author and any number of James Beard Awards, so he's written a fair amount about food. His the thing we're discussing is an article that published recently in the Huffington Post called "Are We Handling the Bee Crisis All Wrong?" You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Are wild bees underappreciated by the agricultural community?
They are, but that is starting to change now with certain crops. Sort of like the progressive edge of the farming community is starting to experiment, and the experiments are becoming, it's very clear that some of these other bee species are incredibly good at pollinating. And, you know, working with them requires learning a few different techniques, but they're very quickly becoming more popular. So I think we actually are going to see a big shift toward a lot of these alternative bee species.
Researchers in Vermont asked, if you have more native bees, do you get more blueberries? So taking it more broadly, if your goal is to grow native crops, is it better to pollinate with native pollinators?
Absolutely. It definitely is. So the ideal, and that's kind of what Charlie Nicholson, the UVM researcher, was looking at here in Vermont. Like, what's going to give you more blueberries? So he looked at 15 different farms around the state that were in a lot of different conditions. Some of them were in more urban developed areas, some were in really wild areas, and some used more organic practices and some used conventional practices. And what he found, which really isn't that surprising, is that the farms in urban areas might only get a few visits from pollinators per bush in 10 minutes. But the farms that had lots of natural areas surrounding them were getting more like 20 or 30 visits per 10 minutes. And the farms that were using organic methods had about twice the pollinator visits of farms that didn't use organic methods.
So, as you report, the Vermont team recorded the numbers and identities of bees on 15 blueberry farms across the state, as well as the yield. And the more visits from wild bees led to bigger, better, and more bountiful berries.
Right, right. And there was one farm in particular. When I looked at the tables of the paper, the scientific paper, like one thing jumped out at me. You could see this pretty normal line sloping upward, where more natural areas, more natural habitat led to more visits from bees. But then there's this one farm that was way off the charts. It totally broke the curve. It was getting about 50 pollinator visits for 10 minutes, which was twice as much as even the other farms that were in natural areas. And that was the farm I visited in the article, a place called Knoll Farm, to sort of see if we could figure out what was going so right there.
And did you ever figure out what was going so right?
Well, it's all speculative.
Helen Wybrow is the farmer there?
Yeah, Helen Wybrow. And she's got a pretty remarkable farmer. She really manages her whole farm as an ecosystem. And so the UVM researchers that I was with, they call it a superstar farm, and their hunch, or their speculation, is that she's actually farming pollinators as much as she's farming blueberries. So not only is she using organic methods, so she's not using pesticides that would kill the bees, she's also allows quite a bit of her farm to stay in a natural state. So there's sort of this unfolding series of wildflowers throughout the farm throughout the season, which is one of the main things you need if you're gonna have a local population of wild bees. Basically, you need to give them a place to live, food to eat, and you need to not kill them, right? So don't use pesticides, and then make sure they have places to nest and a constant supply of food. Because if you only have blueberries, that's going to provide food while the blueberries are flowering, which is only for a couple of weeks. But then the bees need to survive through the rest of the year. So her farm really does look almost like a natural preserve with these apple orchards and berry bushes in the midst of it. And it also has water. It's got, it, which which insects need, and even along the edges of the stream bank is mud, which a lot of these wild bees need to build their nests. So it's kind of got all the resources that wild pollinators might need.
And Helen Fybrow says that she's a messy farmer, happy to live side by side with lots of weeds. Now, when we're talking about weeds, are we talking about all weeds or certain kinds of weeds, weeds that encourage pollinators? I mean, I'm thinking about milkweed, which is absolutely necessary if you want to have monarch butterflies.
Exactly.
Butterflies pollinators?
They are. For certain things, they're important pollinators, including milkweed. That's one that the monarchs are one of the few sort of like bright lights where people have realized if we destroy all the weeds, if we get rid of all the hedgerows that old school farms used to have, we're going to lose the monarch butterflies because monarch caterpillars depend entirely on milkweeds. So now there's farmers are encouraged to leave certain rows of their farm wild and to let milkweed grow.
And when I asked Douglas Tallamy, who has written a lot about native plants, about milkweed being a weed, he said, well, why don't we just call it Monarch's Delight, and then we won't have a problem there.
Well, right. Like, if you ask a bee, they've never seen a weed. They just see food.
Helen Fybrow complained that her blueberry bushes are so productive that at times it becomes a burden. Poor
yeah,
thing.
And it's fun. I just got an emergency like SOS email from her saying, "Please come pick. The fruit is falling off onto the ground."
We should all be so lucky. A beekeeper in Vermont told my producer that everyone should plant a pollinator garden, specifically native wildflowers, so that bees have an oasis when they're searching for food. Did the scientists with whom you spoke share that view?
They did, absolutely. And in fact, they said, when people heard about this, the diversity crisis with bees, the response was to keep beehives. And they said, that's the worst thing that you can do. That's kind of like being worried about bird diversity and keeping chickens as a solution. Because bees are really livestock, like chickens are. So they said, rather, if you care about bee and insect diversity, don't use pesticides and grow lots of wild flowers on your land, which will give the bees what they need.
And does it help if your neighbors are also doing something similar? I've spoken to farmers who try to grow corn the old-fashioned way, and then they point to their neighbors who are just have the corn jammed together and are using all sorts of pesticides to control things, and say that actually has a negative effect on what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I've looked at that a little bit too. Like if you're using, say, if farmers who are growing Roundup Ready corn, which is genetically engineered to withstand spraying of Roundup, then if you spray Roundup and some of it spreads onto your neighbor who's growing regular corn, it's going to kill his corn. So yeah, it definitely it's probably good not to be next to a high chemical intensive farming operation.
Because the wind brings the Roundup to its next door, your next door neighbor.
Right.
And hasn't Roundup been recently the subject of a number of lawsuits? Lost a few cases.
It lost a huge one in California. A groundskeeper who had contracted cancer won. He sued and won, I don't know, it was like $280 million. It was huge. And actually, the science was a little suspect in that case, I thought. But yeah, and Roundup, Monsanto has lost a few cases lately on that one.
So if it may cause cancer, why would we want to eat food that's been sprayed with it?
Well, right, but I'm no fan of pesticides, but on that case, I think it is a little murkier. The agency that listed glyphosate as a potential cancer risk, it's kind of at the same level of risk as hot liquids mm-hmm. for cancer. That gets overlooked sometimes. So in theory, your tea and coffee is also as dangerous as your glyphosate, your Roundup.
One of your books is called American Terroir, and the French talk a lot about how important terroir is to the quality of the things that they grow, especially when you're talking about wine grapes. How important is soil in this whole conversation?
Quite important. And it's kind of it's the other side of the same coin, the way I think about it, in terms of with pollination, because it's like for a while we thought no one paid attention to soil, and there are a lot of farming practices that actually really killed your soil and made it much less productive. And now, past 20 years or so, we've sort of come around, and more and more, it's becoming more and more mainstream to worry about the health of your soil and to realize that if your soil is fertile, you're going to have a better crop. So then I sort of think of the pollination issue as not only do you need fertile soil, you need fertile air, too, which means pollinators. And that's people haven't paid attention to that part of it, but it's as important to have fertile air as it is to have fertile soil. And we've done things that have basically made the air pretty sterile, too.
Hmm. Vermont is a rural, relatively undeveloped state. Can Helen Wybrow's approach to relying on wild bees apply to the big agricultural centers like New York's Hudson Valley or the Central Valley in California?
Yeah, you know, I asked the scientists that same question, and they said they don't exactly know. Like, in some places it'll work, and in some places it won't. And yeah, California is a good example. You've got in the Central Valley, there's not any wild land there. And
what about wild bees? Are there wild bees there?
Not really, not really. There is a movement among a bunch of almond growers to start having their own wild bees on site there. So there's a bee called the Blue Orchard Bee that is a really, really good pollinator of almonds. It's about 10 times as good as a honeybee. And it likes to live in little holes in a tree or something. So they'll actually make little bee hotels for their Blue Orchard bees. And that seems to be working pretty well.
Can they can they capture wild bees in Vermont or in New York and bring them to California?
There's a burgeoning business for Blue Orchard bees and some of these other alternative pollinator bees. So you can actually just order your little Blue Orchard bee starter set online, but you have to have the right spot for them because they're not going to be moved around the country. So they're going to be permanent. I think we're definitely going to see more of that. So even in really intensive agricultural areas, you can do that kind of thing. But one of the other papers that I looked at by the same team of pollination researchers kind of looked at small farms around the world, because there's still about, I think there's like 2 billion people who live on small farms and depend on small farms. And they found that all those farms could get about a 20 to 25% bump in yield of their crops by managing their land for better pollinator habitat.
That's Taylor Ricketts of the Gund Institute for Environment at the University of Vermont.
Exactly. This is one of Taylor Ricketts' studies.
Yeah, they looked at 41 farms on 6 continents that grew almonds, blueberries, buckwheat, cherries, coffee, cotton, kiwi, mango, passion fruit, pumpkin, strawberries, watermelon, and they found that wild insects increased fruiting in every single farm where they were present. Honeybees only produced a significant increase in fruiting 14% of the time.
Right. They're the key. And a lot of in a lot of the developing world, they still have enough wild areas or somewhat natural areas that it's not that hard to start managing for diversity. And it's also very it's cheap. And so you can easily get a nice little bump in yield just by changing your practices.
I'm speaking with Rowan Jacobson, on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
We all know them. But these bees, they got a problem. They got a problem, yeah? The humble bumblebees are dying in the hives because they've been licking them funky pesticides. They ain't been making no honey for you, honey. We have to hurry, pollination is down, and that's a worry. And if they die, we're gonna miss them because they sustain our ecosystem, which means we won't survive if we don't keep those bees alive. Somebody gotta save the bees. Somebody gotta save them goddamn bees. Somebody gotta save the bees, those funky flies with stripes. Somebody gotta save the bees, they're the tigers of the sky. Somebody gotta save them hot man goddamn funky bees.
I'm speaking with Rowan Jacobson. His latest article for Huffington Post is "Are We Handling the Bee Crisis All Wrong?" And it's my sense that your answer to that question would be yes at the moment.
Yes, I think what we just need to play that song more often, and things will all be fine.
Well, obviously, there are people out there who recognize that there's a problem beyond you. How did you get involved in researching this? Although, as you said earlier, you'd written about honeybees in a book.
Yeah, it really started for me when colony collapse first came to everybody's attention, which was back in 2006. And before then, I no more so than anyone else, I hadn't really wrapped my head around how much of our food production was really tied to bees, and that interested me. And you know, there was kind of a scary angle to that at the time. People, you know, there was an apocryphal quote from Einstein saying, like, you know, if the honeybee disappears, then, you know, man will follow. But as I got into it, I just became really fascinated by this partnership between bees and people, which went back so far, because insects, you know, tend to get a really bad rap. And paying attention to honeybees, sort of, it shifted my thinking on insects, and I began to see them in a different and much more positive light.
And now you're seeing them in a less positive light because they're not indigenous. You're talking about wild bees instead. What about climate change? That's another big issue right now. Is that having any impact on bee populations?
Almost definitely. And that's another thing they've looked at a lot, that it's going to impact bee populations, and then it's going to impact our food. One of the weird things that happens, plants and insects adjust differently to climate change, but as the seasons shift, they try to shift. But with bees and plants, if one shifts and the other doesn't, then they get out of step together, because basically the plants have to be blooming when the insects are active for the whole system to work. So if the plants bloom early because of climate change, but the insects haven't adjusted yet, then there's nobody to pollinate those plants, and then when the insects do come along, they don't have that food to eat anymore. So there's worries that they will get out of sync, and that could be really bad. But more specifically, Taylor Ricketts has looked at coffee growing around the world and thinks that is probably the one that's most susceptible to climate change. Coffee is a tropical crop that likes the coffee tree likes to grow in rainforest type settings, and it often grows at, you know, fairly high altitudes in the tropics. But as the climate warms, it's going to have to move up, and it you know, all these mountains that it grows on in Africa and Central America, places like that. And as you go up the mountain, of course, you get less and less territory. So as coffee growing adjusts to climate change, eventually they're going to get chased up too high on a lot of these mountains, and they're going to have nowhere to go. So and along with that, the pollinators, coffee is one of the plants that does best with wild pollinators. So as climate change shifts coffee growing, it could really reduce yields. for coffee, so coffee could get a lot more expensive.
I'm surprised to hear that because, as I understand it, coffee originated in the Middle East and now is grown all over the world. We have coffee, as you point out, growing in South America, in Central America, in Hawaii, as well as Africa. Did we even grow some in the United States?
Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
Hawaii's the only.
I mean, other than Hawaii.
Yeah, no, just Hawaii.
I don't mean to insult Hawaii.
it grows in this in this belt of, like, around the equator, all around the world, but in that belt, and all the best coffees are high altitude coffees, like places like Kenya and Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. So they could be very susceptible. Those habitats, and they're also it requires a lot of water. So if those areas become drier, then coffee's in big trouble.
What is flower stigma?
So the stigma is if you picture your typical flower, you got the petals, and then in the middle of the flower, you have this little tiny tube that comes up, mm-hmm. and that's the stigma.
That's the tube you were talking about earlier?
Right, right. So that's the tube where the pollen has to hit that tube, and then once it does, through, you know, magic, it sends a little tendril down through that tube to the ovaries, which are at the base of the flower, and that's how, that's the birds and the bees for plants. So that stigma is where, like, the bees have to pick up pollen, which is carried on the little things that look almost like grains of rice, which are called anthers, which are around that central stigma. So that's the male part, and then the stigma is the female part. So the bees have to pick up the pollen from the little anthers, go to a different plant, and accidentally brush off that pollen on the stigma in the center of the flower.
So honeybees visit a single plant and then bring the nectar straight back to the hive to make more honey. So they are not visiting as many plants. And I've heard that honeybees tend to specialize in one type of flower. Is that true?
Yeah, well, so they're all working for the hive. They're like definitely hive minds. So they are all out gathering and nectar and bringing it back to the hive. So they'll hit a particular plant, but if they can fill up on that one plant, they'll do that and then go back and unload at the hive like little tanker trucks. So they don't necessarily graze on different varieties of plants within the same like mission, the same flight run, as much as some wild bugs.
And the wild bees are just doing it they're grazing to eat their breakfast and lunch?
Exactly.
Nothing more?
Yeah, they're great, just like a cow in a field. They're just cruising around eating a variety of things.
Beekeepers are some of the most impassioned advocates for bees, but what's been their reaction, the reaction within the beekeeping community to the research that we've been discussing?
I think it's still coming, maybe, and it may come any moment now. Mm-hmm. Can they start
collecting wild bees and bringing them all over the country?
You really can't. They don't play nice in our like honeybees. It's remarkable, really, that we've found this bug that is very happy to live in a wooden box, 40,000, 50,000 bees to a box, and be trucked around the country. We're not going to get any other bug to do that. So we should not be throwing honeybees under the bus. They are our most important pollinator in terms of keeping agriculture alive. They're just problematic in various ways. So we don't want to give them the boot. In fact, one of the really interesting things in these studies, it found that the contributions of wild bees and honeybees were independent from each other. So if you brought in wild bees to pollinate your almond orchard, the almonds they made were not necessarily replacing the almonds that the honeybees made. They each graze in different ways. Like they hit different heights on the tree, and they are attracted to they look for certain for slightly different flowers. So both have contributions that the other ones can't fill in for.
Did Helen Weibrow actively choose to rely on wild bees, or was that just a happy coincidence?
She did. She kind of found her way to it. She's kind of on the leading edge of what apparently a lot of blueberry growers are realizing, and not just blueberry growers, but other growers too. Her first 3 years that she had her blueberry farm, she did bring in honeybees. She kept honeybee hives on the farm because she, like other blueberry farmers, had been told, oh, you've got to have honeybees if you want a good yield on your blueberries. And then just sort of by like observing and watching, experimenting, and hearing a little bit from scientists, she began to question that. She began to notice how many bumblebees and mining bees she had on her blueberry bushes. And she noticed that the honeybees didn't look that interested in the blueberry bushes. They were kind of more interested in other things. So eventually she stopped keeping them and found that her yields just didn't hurt at all from lack of honeybees. In fact, her yields kept getting better as she managed her habitat better and better for wild bees. And that's the UVM scientist said that's been similar on most of the other blueberry farms they've looked at too, that you don't really see a contribution from honeybees when it comes to blueberries. So fewer and fewer blueberry growers are dealing with them.
Just let nature take its course.
Yeah.
Do factory farms, are they suffering from a pollination deficit?
They are, and they may not even know that they are. But they could, like almost every farm that the scientists have looked at, there was room for growth in terms of, none of them were getting optimum pollination. Helen Wybrow was probably one of the few. So in other areas, especially if you're not getting good wild bees, they're bringing in honeybees because they don't know what else to do, but they probably could be getting much better yields if they had more native bugs around.
And you're suggesting that one of the easiest things that we can do to ensure the global food supply is to enhance populations of wild pollinators. But how would that be done?
So there's pretty simple things you can do on your farm if you have a farm. One, most important, don't use pesticides. Two is just to leave grassy strips and certain areas in native wildflowers so that bees have food to sustain them throughout the year. The other is just making sure there are some areas where the bees can make their nests. So that some of them nest in the ground, some of them nest under tufts of grass, and some of them nest in holes in trees. So as long as you have that kind of, just like, it doesn't even have to be that natural. That was one of the other interesting conclusions of that meta-analysis of contributions of wild pollinators all over the world, was that even though wild pollinators were delivering more overall value to crops than honeybees, they found that it couldn't really be a good argument for maintaining true wilderness areas because almost all the contribution to pollination that were happening were coming from a handful of fairly common wild bees that are happy to live on farms or nearby. So it wasn't a good argument for, you know, Yellowstone National Park, but it was a good argument for organic farming.
On one of our previous shows, we talked about insect apocalypses. Are wild and native bees affected by the global die-off? Didn't one of Ricketts' grad students, Insu Ko, find that wild bee abundance in the U.S. has plunged 23% in just 5 years?
Yeah, which is pretty fast. To drop that fast in 5 years is pretty bad. That is definitely part of the insect apocalypse, which a couple years ago, that headline, that theme got a lot of play in the press and possibly got overdone a little bit. It started after this group of German entomologists who's been counting insects in the same wild areas in Germany for like 30 years found that over that time period, insect total biomass had plunged by like 76%, and they announced that, and you know, people started talking about the insect apocalypse. And then a study of Puerto Rican rainforests over the same period showed about a 90% drop in insect numbers, which is really, really pretty shocking. So then people began predicting that 40% of insect species were going to go extinct in a few decades, which seems to be overplayed a little bit, but the responsible studies that have been done all show clear declines in insect numbers across the board. And Insu Ko's study found something particularly interesting, which is that the places in the United States where wild bees were declining the most also were the same places where the crops that need wild bees the most were being planted, places like the Midwest and California. So we're really setting ourselves up for a big mismatch in pollination needs and pollination services available.
So do scientists foresee a time when there won't be enough pollination power for Central Valley?
I think for sure. I mean,
Midwest?
Right now honeybees are having to handle it all, and as we're learning more and more, they're very imperfect when it comes to doing that.
You say that the honeybees themselves are part of the problem because diseases spread quickly between honeybee operations, and you say they're basically the urban slums of the bee world.
Yeah, if you think about human diseases, they spread fastest in densely populated areas, so urban areas where they can go from person to person most easily. Same thing is true with wild insects, and honeybees kind of like are the only bees that build these urban centers. So they tend to have a lot of diseases. And then, of course, the things that we have to do because of our system pollination makes it that much worse. So of those 2.5 million hives in the U.S., about 2 million of them descend on California's Central Valley for almond pollination in February. And they all mingle together in the almond orchards. So there's no, and then they scatter all around the country. There's no better way to spread a pandemic than to put everybody together in kind of like one big Woodstock mosh pit in the almonds and then let them go everywhere. So that seems to be a total vector for diseases. Until recently, no one had really looked at whether those honeybee diseases could carry over to wild populations, but now the first couple studies have recently come out and show clearly that they can. One study I just looked at of flowers near apiaries found that the flowers themselves were just covered in viruses that the honeybees had dropped off there, and that the bumblebees who live near apiaries in wild areas near apiaries had many more diseases than bumblebees that were not living near honeybees. So it's kind of like the doorknob effect. When you've got the flu, you know, if somebody touches the doorknob and then you hit the doorknob, you can pick up the flu. That's the honeybees are dropping off these viruses on flowers, and then wild bees come and visit the same flowers and pick up the virus.
In fact, a study by Allison Brody found that flowers near apiaries were crawling with bee viruses. How many viruses are we talking about? Is collapsing syndrome, collapsing colony syndrome, the result of more than one disease?
Probably. No one's ever been able to figure out exactly what colony collapse disorder was, but they definitely found a bunch of new viruses when they looked, and they also found certain viruses that they already knew were a big problem for bees. There's probably a lot more that they didn't even know to look for. Bees just have a lot of viruses.
Hmm. Is that why they sting us? I mean, is stinging part of part of this whole process, or is that just something that's coincidental?
Yeah, that's their defense mechanism for whatever reason. But that's a good point. I often see. I ended up hanging out with a bunch of beekeepers and a bunch of bees while I was working on my book, and I became much more comfortable with bees landing on me. And now I see people, you know, a bee shows up and people panic and start swatting at that bee. And that's how, if you want a bee to sting you, that's how you'll get it done. If you, it's pretty hard to get a bee to sting you otherwise. Though it's really wasps and especially yellow jackets that do most of the stinging. But bees often get the blame because they're all little, you know, black and yellow striped insects.
Do mosquitoes pollinate?
I think the male mosquitoes do pollinate. The females.
There has to be some explanation for mosquitoes being in the world.
Yeah, I think the males do. They drink nectar from flowers, so they probably do handle a little some pollination. The females, of course, they're looking for their blood meal, but they may also go for nectar when they're not doing that. I'm not sure.
Are wild bees affected by habitat destruction, which is something that is happening or about to happen more now with the Trump administration's new endangered species rules?
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. That's their number one threat to them, more so than even than pesticides. Habitat destruction is the biggie. And a lot of that has to do with agricultural intensification. But also, yeah, the changes to the endangered species rule could also be really, really bad.
Are there enough native bees in non-farming communities like the suburbs where you still find a lot of plants?
Suburbs aren't necessarily terrible. Yeah, if you've got a lot of flowers and you do have some wild areas or even overgrown areas, bees, you know, they like ground mowed grass. They don't need much. It's interesting, and you can of course manage. You can put up little bee hotels as well as manage for wildflowers. So bees don't need like vast tracts of wilderness.
You mentioned organic farming. Does that attract more native pollinator visits than conventional farming?
Yes, much more. I think about twice as much. Partly because you're not killing your bees, but also because organic farms tend to have more wildflowers, you know, quote-unquote weeds, growing around the edges. And those turn out to be important for getting bees through the whole season.
And as you point out, bees have problems surviving harsh northern winters. On the other hand, with climate change, this July, this last July, was the hottest July in recorded history all over the world.
Right. Hottest month period, I think, of all time.
So I don't know whether that is a positive or a negative for bees. Can it get too hot for bees?
For sure, yeah. Honeybees like it hot. You know, they're like I said, a total tropical species originally. They can take the heat. They don't like it cold, and that's actually one of the other advantages of native bees is that a bumblebee, for example, will fly, you know, early morning when it's 45 degrees. And no, the honeybees, you know, they're like good union workers. They're staying inside until it's 9 a.m. and 60 degrees, and the foreman says, okay, go to work. Bumblebees will operate at much cooler temperatures, and that's true for other wild bees, too. So climate change, if anything, may favor honeybees.
Now, you mentioned that people like Helen Weibrow have learned that you can let the weeds run amok, and that really creates diversity and a natural habitat for wild bees. But are we going to be able to convince factory farmers that they have to devote some of their land to plants that are not going to be producing income?
Yeah, that's going to be a toughie. There's been some push to do that, to at least preserve certain hedgerows. But I think it's only going to happen if the factory farm approach starts to not work so well. I think if it becomes economically savvy to start to move in another direction, everyone will do it pretty quickly. So if our sort of conventional system of pollination starts to fail, then everyone will move towards something else. And that's already happening a little bit, like with these guys who are using Blue Orchard bees and some of these other alternative bees.
On the other hand, we have any number of people who are climate change deniers. Do we see that in the farming community as well, or all the research that you have been reporting on just dismissed?
Yeah, I haven't seen the research dismissed, but you know, if I'm a farmer, I'm going to be skeptical of everything new that comes along. So, like, convince me, show me the results, and then I'll change. So I think that's what will start to happen. So, for example, I know Cornell just put out a new app for apple growers in the Northeast, because apple growers have also traditionally brought in honeybee hives. But the Cornell scientists started, you know, looking at what was actually happening with pollination and realizing that a lot of these honeybee hives were completely unnecessary. So they actually created an app that no matter where you are, if you're an apple grower, you can find out what your surrounding wild bee populations are like, and the app helps you decide how many, if any, honeybee hives you need to bring in. So, and what that app is basically going to be doing is it's going to be pushing all those apple guys away from honeybees and toward alternatives.
Now, I'm curious about what brings you to a subject. For example, you've written a number of books and articles on oysters and things. You have Shadows of the Gulf, The Living Shore. Then you also have things about apples and chocolate. Does one thing lead to the other?
It does. And then there's a whole gene editing window in the middle of all that, which kind of, you know, what I kind of like, if something comes along and I realize I don't really understand that thing, like, or I've misunderstood it, then that fascinates me and I want to learn about it, at least enough about it to hold up for a one-hour radio interview, for example.
Well, we really appreciate that you've held up for a one-hour radio interview. my congratulations to you for all the James Beard Awards. You won the Noel Thomas Award from the Society of American Travel Writers.
Yeah, that's the other draw. Sometimes it's pure lifestyle. If I get to go somewhere really exotic and dive into a new world, that's always appealing too.
And what kind of feedback have you gotten from the article in Huffington Post? Are we handling the bee crisis all wrong? Have farmers been writing to you?
Yeah, I've heard from a lot of farmers, a lot of blueberry farmers in particular, who are already sort of ahead of the curve on this one, and are pleased that, you know, other people are finally paying attention.
But it's only blueberries and not blackberries or some of the other berries out there?
It is other berries. Blueberries are sort of like the biggest one where it's really obvious that other bees work better. Pumpkins, squashes, cranberries is another big one. But the cranberry guys have so many problems. Like pollination's kind of the last of their worries right now.
Well, cranberries require a lot of water, don't they?
A lot of water, and prices are insanely low right now. So it's tough to make a go of it as a cranberry farmer.
Rowan Jacobson's article, Are We Handling the Bee Crisis All Wrong?, can be found at Huffington Post. Thank you so much for being on our show. It's been really fascinating.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to Susie Stultz, who produced this segment, and to our live engineer, Richie Johnson, executive producer, Jesse Lind, for all their help throughout the week. If you're new to our show and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter and our website, LeonardLopateAtLarge.com, where you can find links to all of our past shows. The Tom Hartman Show is coming up next, and I hope that you will tune in on Monday when David Kirp will join us to discuss his book, The College Dropout Scandal. Have a great weekend.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI New York, and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Leonard Lopate at Large, heard Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. Stay tuned for the Tom Hartman program, but first, news headlines from Democracy Now!
Israel's announced it will conditionally allow Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib to visit family in the West Bank a day after barring both Tlaib and fellow Congresswoman Ilhan Omar from entering Israel to travel to the occupied territories. Israel is still refusing entry to Omar. Israel initially blocked entry to both lawmakers after President Trump took the unprecedented step of publicly urging Israel to bar entry to the women, the first two female Muslim members of Congress. On Thursday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended Israel's initial decision to bar both of the U.S. lawmakers.
By law, we are not willing to admit anyone into Israel who calls for the boycott of the state of Israel and acts to delegitimize the state of the Jews.
Israeli authorities say Rashida Tlaib will now be allowed entry on humanitarian grounds to visit her ailing 90-year-old grandmother on the condition she does not promote the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement during her visit. Israel's initial decision was widely denounced even by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. On Thursday, Congressmember Tlaib tweeted,